be only one justification for the existence of this center of learning or for your resort to it. Here you may make the acquaintance of ideas.
This is the voice of Henry Merritt Wriston, 11th president of Brown University. His 18 years on College Hill marked one of the greatest periods of intellectual and physical growth at America's seventh oldest college. A man passionately devoted to the search for truth, he frequently spoke about the nature of a university.
If I were to make a single characteristic which is essential to the life, not to say the greatness of the university, it would be hospitality toward ideas. For a university is, first of all, a treasure house of ideas that are very old. They have been tested and tried times without number and have not been found wanting. The relationship of freedom to the innate dignity of the individual is a characteristic one. And if you fail here to gain acquaintance with these seasoned veterans in the wage-long war against folly, you will never master the art of learning.
Coming to Brown in 1937 from Lawrence College, where he had served as 10th president, Wriston emphasized the ideal of a liberal arts education. He saw it as the balanced growth of individuality and commented that,
"You will never understand the world nor grasp the foundations of peace until you respond to the long struggle of the philosopher to identify and wrestle with the great problem of what is most worthwhile in the life of mankind. Nor will you learn what is truth unless you study its relationship to beauty, unless you seek to understand what music and art and poetry have to contribute to the knowledge and experience of reality. Those who regard such things as frills, as mere decorations or something with which to while away an hour, are impoverishing themselves. And as students, you have no more right to squander your intellectual inheritance than to throw your money into the street."
This intellectual inheritance was preserved, he felt, in the college. Yet college was something more than this.
College is a place to grow up, to learn from books, to improve the mind, to acquire a modicum of social grace. But it is all wasted if you do not grow up morally, if you do not acquire, among other things, the moral courage to take some position and stand on it.
Moral courage, Wriston felt, was in crisis due to the pressure of the times. Conformity, the fear of being different, was, in his opinion, an ever dangerous threat to the American tradition.
The word controversial had become a dirty word. And that worries me because that occasionally has been applied to me. Not properly, of course, but it's been applied to me. But something worse happened. As some of you know, I'm one of the few living men who knew both Alger Hiss and Harry Dexter White. The fact is, I employed both of them. But a Brown man working for the Associated Press in calling me for my impressions of White, which are quite vivid, said that he had called 70 people, and of the 70, only two were willing to give information and have their names used. The rest must be anonymous. Now, that jarred me right down to my marrow of my bones. Just to have known a man 25 years ago has apparently become so dangerous in the minds of people that they, "Please, sir, don't mention me." So I sought to restore this hole in my armor of optimism, and I reviewed again the book of Daniel. You all know who he was. He was a fellow that went into the lion's den. He was the fellow who fed on pulse and water instead of the king's meat.
He was the friend of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And if you don't know any more, you know the Mariners and what they did to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But Daniel was a man who knew what was wrong, and he called it wrong, even when he called it to the king. And he knew what was right, and he did what was right, and he took the consequences.
Riston pointed out examples of physical courage that are all about us. But for proper balance, he felt, moral courage was a necessity.
So we're not lacking in physical courage. But I suggest that when the story of Robin Hood is labeled as communist propaganda, when the children in the schools are urged not to look upon themselves as future citizens of the world, but only of Illinois, when censorship of books is mounting, when security is set above freedom, how many people are ready to speak up? Most of the voices that are being heard in the United States are the voices of arrogance, the voices of bullies, the voices of those who would sacrifice freedom to security. It had better be called sterility. Who regard accusation as conviction, who take rumor as evidence. The situation is well described in a play, Robert's Wife by St. John Irvine. In it, the bishop is one of the characters, and the bishop says, this man has enthusiasm and brains. And that's a combination of qualities that's rare and getting rarer. All the enthusiasts of my acquaintance have no brains, and all the brainy people have no enthusiasm. The world, he said, is dying of hot heads and cold feet. Now, we should have learned by experience with the Kaiser, those of you who are oldest, and those of you younger should have learned by our experience with Hitler, that you cannot appease a bully. And that every time you appease a bully, you strengthen him and weaken yourself. And that is just as true of freedom of speech and freedom of thought as it is in international relations. And if you believe in freedom, if liberty means anything to you, then you must see that the Bill of Rights is observed in all of its phases and stand up and be counted among those who speak for freedom and do not cower because there are bullies abroad in the world. Meet it in the only way it can be met, with faith and with courage and with depth of belief. And dare, if you will, to be a Daniel.
Riston saw the threat to civil liberties especially evident in the attitude of some individuals who would attempt to censor thought in the universities of the nation.
And I say to you that if we impair the capital of the institutions which are at the foundation of our scientific and our technological, our medical advance, then we are simply selling our descendants short to a degree that the debt doesn't even threaten. But when you stop to think that since 1900, the average expectation of life in the United States has increased by 20 years. That is a direct and immediate reflection of the research carried on in the universities, of the training of doctors carried on in the universities, and of all that has followed upon that in the hospitals of the United States. And sometimes when some stupid head says, don't give them money until they use a different textbook in economics, ask him in God's name what they're talking about. Are they going to stop the development of science and of technology and of medicine in the United States until some chump finds a book that doesn't teach anybody anything.
Riston was a man noted for wisdom in foreign affairs. Speaking at chapel on VE Day in 1945, he foresaw that
the hope of the world for peace rests upon two pivots, one in Washington, the other in Moscow.
Addressing the seniors at chapel on the 10th anniversary of VE Day, he noted the necessity for a sense of individual responsibility for world peace.
For it is as plain as anything can be that the drift of the world has been toward war. And it is time now to start the hard beat to windward with peace as the ultimate haven. 10 years after VE Day, turn your eyes back and consider this decade just passed. And if you will appraise it rightly, there will come to you as American citizens a surge of confidence which the past behavior of our nation in this treacherous era fully justifies. But avoid at all hazards arrogance and boastfulness, for the greatness of the United States and its nearly dominant position in the world today lay upon us new responsibilities. These will require not alone courage and strength and confidence, they will require even more, a deep humility and profound spiritual commitment.
But frequently, amidst the weightier problems of international relations, he saw the humor of the issue.
You know what appeasement is? Appeasement is a negotiation that doesn't succeed. When you negotiate, you give a quid pro quo. And then the question comes is, if you deliver the quid, will the other fellow deliver the quo? And you have to ask the question, is the quo worth the quid and the quid the quo? And if the quid isn't worth the quo or the quo the quid, and if the other fellow doesn't deliver the quo when you deliver the quid, that's appeasement.
And of the chances for peace, he said,
for those who want a stable peace, want what never was, is not now, and probably never shall be. For peace has to do with persons, and persons are not perfectly stable. And when you get millions upon millions upon billions of unstable people stabling together, you're going to have some instability. For it is men who make war, and men only. And human nature being what it is, there must be their adventures of peace and the risks of peace, or adventures of war and the risks of war.
Riston, a lover of the democratic ideal, often spoke out against those who would not grasp the opportunities to perfect that ideal. His criticism sometimes focused on the nation's capital.
Indeed, some senators are among our principal security risks. And having made the violation of security a criminal offense, on their own whim, they decide when they should disobey the law and publish classified material. Even when they do not consciously reveal important information, the eternal search for headlines induces such indiscretions as would be denounced in any less august body. The Senate seems now to have decided that the legislative function assigned to it by the Constitution is dull business, and therefore they put their energies into pursuing investigations which elaborate the obvious, make mountains out of old hills, supply material to the Kremlin, or just a few more black headlines. Congress has both the right and the power to investigate, but it has an obligation to legislate. And with all the real and urgent problems facing us today, a helter-skelter tax system, a controversial Labor Relations Act, chaotic budget procedure, a self-defeating farm program,
the whole problem of foreign relations, there's plenty for Congress to do beside looking under every bed to find a lurking communist. Nevertheless, members rush about searching for motes in their neighbor's eyes, or neglecting the beam that is in their own. Well, the Senate is one of the most ill-disciplined legislative bodies in the world. Its procedures are archaic. The method of selecting chairman of important committees is fantastic. It gives splinter groups control of its own procedures and control of its time in ways that are frivolous. In short, it has a cure for everything but its own faults.
And bureaucracy caught it too. Reporting on his service as an advisor to the State Department in Washington, Wriston gave glimpses of the red tape jungle.
Moreover, in the building, most people are industrious to a fault. I've been trying to get to the office earlier than the staff sometime. Never succeeded yet. When I fight my way out through the hordes of people who want to see me, what they want to see me for, I've never found out, but boy, how they like to see you. Sometime after 6 o'clock, those two girls are still there, and they can't leave until they can go in and take every paper that's on my desk and hide it. It's all top secret. That's because it's mostly trivial.
The essence of a bureaucratic problem, Wriston saw as this.
Well, if the organization is good, if the people are industrious, if they're competent, if they have good equipment, why shouldn't the results be perfect? And the reason is as simple as anything can be. That generally speaking, they treat the boundaries of their responsibility as nations treat the boundaries of their countries. And you do not pass across from one boundary zone of responsibility to another without a passport and a visa. I called for some data, and it required the cooperation of two different offices. The two offices supplied each other differing data, and they supplied me something that made no sense at all. And the reason was just that each said, my responsibility goes here, and no further. And the other said, my responsibility comes here to the same spot. You're dealing across boundaries like strangers in a negotiation. And you don't even walk into his office if you can avoid it. I've never received so much mail from down the hall in my life. If a man wants to say something to me, will he pick up a phone and say it? No, I get a note. All the flummy-diddles at the front. All my titles and an index number and everything else, and then you want to buy a dog and sign. This sense of separatism, in other words, often outruns the sense of unity. And the curse of bureaucracy often lies in the beauty of its design and in the dispersal of responsibility, in the loyalty that a man has to the part, to where he works rather than to the whole. And I have thought again and again of the dictum of St. Paul, the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life.
As a speaker of national renown, Wriston was constantly in demand outside the Brown community. But to him, the students were always his favorite audience. Often in chapel talks at both Brown and Pembroke, he set for them the goals of individualism and intellectual perspective.
But above all, I beg you, do not join that faceless multitude who yield up their God-given right to be individuals, who seek to adjust themselves to their environment. That is, to lose themselves in the crowd, who are afraid to take a position, who go through life avoiding responsibility, going through the motions, but hiding behind their fellows. Those are the people who make citizenship sterile. Those are the people who make government costly and often futile. Those are the people who make the churches vapid. Those are the people who make education a pale imitation of the dynamic force that it ought to be in American life.
Speaking at the Pembroke Convocation in 1954, Riston urged the students to forsake their hope for pat solutions to the problems of the world, to come to terms with life, and to face the hazards of independence.
The communists appeal to an all too common desire to avoid standing up and meeting the facts of life. It's easier to retire into anonymity in some great movement. And mark you this, that many more people flee from liberty than are deprived of it. That is the secret of men like Hitler, of the communists, of the McCarthyites, and of 100 lesser isms. Too many people want to avoid the pain of thought. They dread the hazards of independence. They seek to be unnoticed in the crowd. Ortega y Gasset, in explaining the appeal of mass movements of fascism and communism, spoke of this as an era, and I'm quoting him, in which many men, homesick for the herd, devote themselves passionately to whatever is left of the sheep in them. They want to march through life together, along a collective path, shoulder to shoulder, wool rubbing against wool, and the head down.
Fraternities he saw as a basic part of the program, but he reminded them of their inescapable responsibilities to the college community.
Fraternities must justify their position not on the basis of exclusiveness, but through capacity for fellowship. Snobbery cannot be excused on the ground that it is a private vice. It runs too deeply counter to the democratic ideal. It is too fundamentally hostile to democratic practice. Every trace of it should be rooted out of this campus. By deliberate design, the student body is drawn from a wide geographical range, from the whole economic spectrum, from some newly come to this country and others whose lineage reaches back to our earliest time. The liberal college is predicated upon a society fluid in structure, where every individual meets opportunity without barriers of race, religion, or economic or social status. Brown University should have fraternities, constructive forces in the progress toward appreciating people for their minds and characters and personalities, and for nothing else.
Riston also stressed the importance of capitalizing on the moment and deriving from the present a sense of achievement.
Let me summarize my wish, my annual, my perpetual wish. Do not now fix your eye on graduation. Fix your eye on today and get the most out of today. Do not believe that life will ever be more exciting than it is now, or more important, or more rewarding, or more anything else.
Speaking at the faculty club, shortly before the announcement of his retirement, Riston gave his colleagues the inside information on the necessary versatility of a college president.
The third thing a president is supposed to do is raise money. Now, a lot of people put that first, but it is also, next to real estate, the most exhausting and frustrating duty that you have. And it's an enormous strain on character. When you try to tell a donor what the college is like, you're likely to be somewhat extravagant, and you're likely also to make promises. I well remember a senior member of the faculty protesting because of another member of the faculty called the president a liar. And I can hear him now. He was this rather old man, and he oohed between his words. He said, "Ooh, I do